Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Andaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at OseaMalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.
Welcome to Media Confidential. Today, Ukraine. A Russian drone attack on Europe's largest nuclear plant raises the risk of a major nuclear catastrophe in Ukraine. It comes at a time when there are growing fears that the ongoing conflict has become the forgotten war.
So what next for the war and the way the war is being reported? We're joined by staff writer for The Atlantic and Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Anne Applebaum.
This is Media Confidential, your weekly delve behind the headlines and beyond the clickbait to get to the heart of the story in the fast-moving and contested world of news and media. I'm Alan Rusbridger here in Prospect HQ in London.
And I'm Lionel Barber, and today I'm in New York.
Did you go direct from Tokyo, or have you touched back to pick up a pair of underpants and socks from your pad in London?
Well, I did spend 2 days in London, and I did pick up, actually, a couple of ties.
Now, whether you're looking bleary-eyed, you can't know whether it's morning, afternoon, or Tuesday, but what has been on your radar?
Well, I'm in New York, so obviously I'm thinking Donald Trump, and I'm just reading these fascinating stories about his media company, social media platform, Truth Social, what a name, and the valuation on the stock market. I mean, this thing made only 4 million revenue last year, and yet it's valued at 4 billion. And 4 million revenue, by the way, is what an average McDonald's franchise in America makes in terms of revenue. There's a brilliant articles in the Washington Post about the company, about the amount of money that's being drawn out of it by Trump, his lawyers, his political supporters. And it's what's called a meme stock. So people get very excited about the name, they invest, stock goes up, and it's now gone back down 60%. So he's lost a billion. Still worth, by the way, Trump's still going to worth around $3.5 billion if he can sell his shares in 6 months. But that's a story to watch. The other thing, Alan, that caught my eye was the incredible, I'm a bit of a numbers person on this podcast, the legal costs and settlement costs of the phone hacking scandal for Rupert Murdoch's News Corp is incredible. It's risen to £1 billion, and they still haven't settled Prince Harry or Hugh Grant.
They are unbelievable figures. Where do you get these figures from?
I'm reading the Financial Times, the old organ there, Daniel Thomas. Good reporting. Guardian's been very good too.
The Times and the Sun have just declared their figures. They're quite interesting reading. The Times is still making decent profits, about 60 million, which is about equivalent to the losses of the Sun. They more or less cancel each other out, though the Sun's losses have come down because they've set aside less money for phone hacking this year. But both are dwarfed by the losses on Talk TV, which were last year 54 million. So that's lost 88 million so far. So not a resounding success. I was interested in the Sun accounts. It just says costs in relation to UK newspaper matter. It's a very euphemistic way of saying they've risen from 27 million to 45 million. But they are, as you say, eye-watering sums, considering that the same management is now in place that was in place when all the hacking was being done.
And where is the money coming from? Well, the answer is it's Fox, that big money gusher in the United States.
Yeah, well, it's certainly not coming from the UK, because you put those three entities together and there's a loss of 60 million, nearly 60 million in 1 year. So God bless Fox if you're a news international journalist in this country.
Yeah, I think that going back to Talk TV, I mean, we all like to have risk-taking things that are new, but Rebecca Brooks is foray into television does not look to have been a great success. I would say, on the other hand, at times radio seems to be a neat complement to the newspaper operation. That is seems to be making money.
Something that did slightly amuse me was the Sun's EDI report. After all the fun that the Sun pokes at woke competitors, it has actually got an equality, diversity, and inclusion policy of its own, and you'll be pleased to know that they're aiming for 50-50 gender equality, and they're looking to employ 20% minority ethnic employees in the company. So there you are. The next time you read the Sun ridiculing woke companies, we can point to their own admirably woke policies.
Yeah, hold that front page.
I think you're a bit of a fan of Kelvin McKenzie's Twitter feed.
I am. I've started following Kelvin. He's always been tasty, fruity, whatever you want to say, but he had a real go at the Sunday Times in his tweet at the weekend, saying it was empty of any reasonable, readable content. And he said, I hope Lachlan and Rupert are reading the paper because it's certainly not worth £4. I thought, if I was editor of the Sunday Times, I certainly would be choking on my cornflakes over Sunday breakfast.
The other thing that caught my eye was the comedian Joe Lycett has confessed that he's been planting fake news stories over the last month. And this Friday, he's going to be unmasking them all on Channel 4, including, and when I think it, one of those stories is, I don't know if you saw this, Lionel, you probably have more elevated reading matter than I do, but the story about Alan Titchmarsh's trousers, did that cross your horizon?
No, I missed that one, Alan, on the way back from Tokyo.
Well, there was a story in a few papers saying that Alan Titchmarsh, the gardener, his show had been sold to North Korean television, and that the North Koreans, in showing it, had blurred out his jeans because jeans were a symbol of capitalist, imperialist fashion taste. And lots of outlets did run this story with a perfectly straight face, but the story seems to have been planted by Joe Lycett, along with many other stories that he says had taken in the BBC News, The Mail, The Sun, ITV News, Sky News, and The Independent. So there could be a lot of red faces on Friday night when all is revealed.
Civilian deaths and injuries in Ukraine sharply increased by 20% in March compared to February, according to the UN Human Rights Monitoring Commission. This week, Russian drones targeted the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv just days before the Zaporizhia nuclear plant was hit.
But has the conflict in Ukraine become the forgotten war? The October 7th attack by Hamas on Israel and the subsequent war being waged in Gaza has dominated headlines in recent months. And while that war continues, Ukraine has lost an incredible amount in the past 2 years. As of January 2024, an estimated 3.7 million people were internally displaced in Ukraine, and a further 6.3 million Ukrainians were recorded living abroad as refugees.
And now the reconstruction and recovery process is projected to cost around $486 billion over the next 10 years. We asked author and historian Anne Applebaum to take stock of the current situation in the war right now. And before we talk about the media coverage of the Ukraine conflict, could you give us just a state of play at the moment? Because we're hearing a lot of some reporting about the Ukrainians really being on the defensive right now.
So in essence, there are two kinds of war going on right now. One is the ground war, and you're right, the Ukrainians are very much on the defensive. Depending on who you ask, they are outnumbered and out-equipped. The Russians are said to have 5 to 6 times as much ammunition as they do. In this war, it's a little bit easier to hold a line than it is to move forward, and so the Russians are also still taking huge casualties. But mostly because the U.S. Congress has refused to resupply Ukraine, for the most part, for the past 6 months, Ukrainians are very low on ammunition. There's been a big European effort to find ammunition led by the Czech government, some of which has already arrived and some of which will arrive in June. It's actually been a big success. They've got probably at least 1 million rounds of ammunition for Ukraine that nobody thought existed. They found it by buying it around the world. You know, so that's not going well in the sense that they're slowly losing bits of territory. They are out. They're not able to keep it. At the same time, the Ukrainians are conducting a different kind of war as well, which is really unusual and asymmetrical and very high tech. And this is a drone war, in which they've managed to take down enough Russian ships to push the Black Sea Fleet out of the western part of Crimea, away from Crimea. That's allowed Ukraine to go on shipping grain and other things out of its ports, out of Odessa and other ports. They've also begun to use their long-range drones that they've invented. These are bespoke. They were created for this war to hit Russian oil refineries, gas facilities, and more recently, weapons production facilities, you know, in hundreds and sometimes thousands of miles away from Ukraine. And so they're proving they have these abilities to do things that nobody thought they could do. And that means that it's still a war that I would be very wary of calling, you know, as a kind of slam dunk success one way or the other. There are two different tracks that it's running on, and the Ukrainians on the innovative long range track are doing quite well.
And how would you assess the media coverage of this war right now? Because obviously at the beginning, everybody was just bewitched by the stupendous performance as a leader of Vladimir Zelensky. But you get the sense that there's a bit of fatigue set in. I just wonder, you know, if you were wearing your hat as an editor as opposed to a reporter on the front line, where would you be looking for the best news and how would you rate the current reporting?
So the story of Ukraine fatigue has been part of the story from the beginning. I remember being asked in the early days of the war, even, won't we get tired of this? And there has been Russian and sort of pro-Russian messaging to that effect all along. You know, it's going to last too long. It's too exhausting. We can't win. There's no point in helping them. That kind of language has been there from the beginning, and it's been pushed by a huge range of people, ranging from, you know, academics and diplomats to bots and random anonymous people who seem very intrigued in wanting to talk about it online. So it's been a part of the story the whole time. I do think that something did change at the end of last summer when the Ukrainian counteroffensive failed. I mean, it did win back some territory, but it didn't get as far as some had hoped it would have. Retrospectively, the counteroffensive was probably oversold by everybody. It also looks like it was very badly undersupplied. So it wasn't, you know, the Ukrainians didn't have, certainly they didn't have the air power. They didn't have the weapons sufficient to move forward over these, you know, many, many layers of tank traps and defense, and especially not on a battlefield where almost everything is visible, again, because of drones. You know, the Ukrainians, and there's no surprises in this war, the Ukrainians and Russians can see each other. But because the story had been building up to the counteroffensive, after the counteroffensive, there was some kind of sense of, well, now what do we do? And it's true that Zelensky has been less good at remaking the argument. I think probably he himself is quite tired. And the sort of, this is a boring war, let's move on kind of messaging has at the same time grown louder. You know, the funny thing is, it's the really exciting things that are happening are much less covered, partly because they're more covert. As I said, the amazing things that the Ukrainians are doing to the Russian oil refining business, or the extraordinary success that Ukraine, which is a country with basically no navy, has done in defeating the famous Black Sea Fleet. That seems to be undercovered. I mean, mostly because there aren't reporters in Sebastopol when the missiles hit the ships. So there is now a weird way in which that the most important, most exciting things aren't really written about. And, you know, I guess if I were, you know, queen of the universe and queen of the media, I would focus on those things more. The story in Ukraine has also become tied up with the U.S. political story in a very ugly way that I didn't predict. In other words, a part of the Republican Party, apparently at the behest of Trump, has decided from the end of last summer to begin blocking any more money for Ukraine. And this is really quite a dramatic and rather amazing story as well. And this has got a lot of attention. It's very well written about in the U.S. On a visit to the U.K. recently, I discovered that people didn't really understand it. But in the U.S., it's very covered. The drama of the Speaker of the House called Mike Johnson, who seems to be way in over his head, doesn't understand what he's doing, keeps changing the story about what he wants to do. At first, they said, well, we'll only give this aid if there's a new deal on the border, on the laws governing the U.S. border with Mexico. Then when the American Senate came up with a plan to deal with the U.S. border for Mexico, he vetoed it, or he didn't want to talk about it. And that appears to have been under pressure from Trump, who on the one hand doesn't want the border solved because he finds it a useful issue to run on, and secondly, maybe more importantly, is very, very keen to block aid to Ukraine. And that's a little bit mysterious why. We can talk about it if you want. But it's become a very, very important force in U.S. politics. We now have the specter of an out-of-power U.S. president, former U.S. president, who is in effect manipulating American foreign policy. And this is dramatic. It is covered. It's pretty widely written about, and it will continue to be written about.
In immediate terms, Anne, it seems, I wonder if there are three things going on. One is, as you've hinted, the slight sort of, not exactly boredom, but the story isn't changing much from day to day. And there's all this amazing covert stuff going on, but otherwise it's trench warfare, isn't it? And the attention has just switched to Gaza. And the third is, a question of resources that newsrooms, especially television, can sort of do one big story at a time, but two big stories begins to stretch resources in the modern world of media.
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, you two would probably know that better than me, since you both have run big media organizations. But yes, I mean, it's true that Gaza affected the Ukraine stories in a lot of ways. One was in terms of attention. Maybe it's had some military implications. As I understand it, most of what the Israelis need is different from what the Ukrainians need, although there may be some overlaps. But also in the sense of the moral outrage that people felt about Ukraine, you know, which there was and Ukraine is it's not a very nuanced moral story. So the Russians illegitimately attacked Ukraine. When they occupy Ukraine, they set up concentration camps. They kidnap children. They carry out torture. They torment people. You know, they in order to win a battle, they destroy the cities. I mean, every single city that they've taken, has been largely ruined. And so it's an unbelievably destructive, vicious conflict. Gaza is also destructive and vicious, but it's much more complicated and has deeper, more complicated roots. And it also plays into our own, British, American, European prejudices and angers about other things as well, about history of colonialism or history of Israel or history of the Jews, you name it. And so it's polarized and angered people in a different kind of way. And so that has taken some of the emotion that people felt about Ukraine in the beginning of the war has probably lessened because of that. I mean, in my view, not everybody will agree with me, but in my view, the outcome of the Ukraine war is going to matter more for Europe. It will create the conditions for peace or war in Europe over the next generations. And whereas the war in Israel, I don't see how it's resolved anytime soon. I don't know. It's mostly contained in that region, at least for the moment, at least unless the Iranians get involved.
Talking of Europe, I'm sure you read and watch a lot more European media than some in Eastern European media. I assume they haven't got bored with the story.
No, they are very much not bored with the story. Ukraine is a big story in Poland. It's a big story in Germany. I think it's even a big story in France, where Macron belatedly decided, I think he looked at the role the U.S. was playing. He was watching what was going on in Washington, and he decided to make a big foray into the politics of the war. And he began to start talking about theoretically using French troops in Ukraine. And that actually sparked, I don't know how widely known this is either, but that actually sparked a pretty big conversation in Central Europe as well about what's plan B. If the Ukrainians begin to lose territory, what do we do next? And that conversation goes on in different forms you know, there's a NATO meeting this week in which I'm sure it took place. And so, you know, Ukraine very much is still in the news across Europe, I would say.
How easy is this war to cover?
You know, I'm not a war correspondent, so you may have to ask somebody else that. I mean, as I understand it, one of the problems at the front line is the Ukrainians are very reluctant to give journalists access, and they're reluctant to embed people. You know, I understand that's for safety reasons, maybe there are PR reasons, and I know that that's made it hard to get access to the front line if you're the kind of journalist who wants to do that kind of frontline coverage. So that makes it hard. And then, as I said, some of the most exciting aspects of the war are things that we can only really see on little clips that people put up on Telegram channels, you know, an oil refinery exploding somewhere in the middle of Russia. And so having access to that part of the story, I think, is quite difficult. More broadly, having access to the Ukrainian political story and talking to people into Ukraine and getting to Ukraine is not very difficult. Actually, Kiev is actually very, you can't fly there. I suppose that's, you have to take the train. But once you're there, it's very easy city to get around. It's not very dangerous. It doesn't feel tense. People will talk to you. It's a, you know, Ukraine is a very open society, so it doesn't feel, it's not secretive or difficult to find people to talk to. You can very easily meet people who don't like Zelensky. They're happy to talk about that. I mean, of course, you can meet people who like him as well. But I'm in the sense that the politics are very open and conversation is very free. But actually, the front line, I think, is rather difficult to cover.
Can you talk a little bit more about Russian disinformation and its role, success in shaping the narrative in this war?
So these things are very hard to measure. But it's pretty clear that we are now looking at, I've just written a story that will be in the Atlantic in about a month, because it's going on the cover of the June edition, I think. It's also part of my new book, which is called Autocracy Inc., and which appears in July. And one of the stories that I tell in the Atlantic and in the book is about the ways in which the autocracies that care about these things have begun to work together to produce common narratives. And one of the things that's become clear during this war is the ways in which Russia and China work together, with sort of Iran and Venezuela playing little side roles. So certainly if you look at how people talk about the war in Africa or in Latin America, you have to first reckon with the fact of the enormous Chinese media presence in Africa, both in terms of content sharing agreements with Xinhua or with other or with Chinese television, also Chinese television itself, also Chinese journalism, training programs. The presence of China everywhere in the media is very, very strong. And until recently, a lot of that presence was used really to promote China or Chinese business. And, you know, there was a book written not too long ago about the Chinese sort of influence campaigns around the world, and noted that a lot of them were just very boring. More recently, they've begun to collaborate pretty openly with Russia, and they push Russian propaganda. And so a really interesting example comes from the very beginning of the war, when there was this extraordinary and rather bizarre story about Ukrainian biolabs. And I find that lots of Americans and British and Europeans don't even remember it. But there was a big story that the U.S. had biolabs in Ukraine, and that one of the sort of excuses for Russia invading Ukraine was they needed to, I don't know, disarm these biolabs. And even there was a line that the biolabs are working with bat viruses, if that sounds familiar, and maybe planning, implication being that they're planning a new pandemic. I mean, it was such a ridiculous story that it was even debunked at the UN Security Council. I mean, it was debunked multiple times by everybody who could possibly debunk it. Nevertheless, it was repeated by Russian officials, by Chinese officials. It went on Russian state media, Chinese state media. It was then repeated in Venezuelan and Iranian media. It also appeared in some of these information laundering sites that the Russians, mostly the Russians, have created, you know, websites that look like they're Latin American or they look like they're Arab, but really they just recycle material from RT or from Russian media. And it really went everywhere all over the world, so much so that something like a third of Americans believe it to be true. It was part of the American far right supported it. Tucker Carlson talked about it. It was Alex Jones. These are American conspiracy theorists who are very popular. And so something like a third of Americans believed it. And some, I don't know that any statistics have been done in Africa, but you could hear it being repeated constantly there too. Then you have to ask, what did that, you know, did it matter? And I think probably yes, I think it did matter in terms of shaping perceptions of the war, who's really interested. You know, if you're worried about biolabs, then you're less concerned about the concentration camps that Russia is building in Ukraine. You're much more likely to trust news that comes from the West or from NATO about Ukraine if you think really this war is all about biolabs. So again, it was a kind of almost ridiculous story. There was even an even more ridiculous piece of it, which was that supposedly there were birds that were spreading biological disease, Ukrainian birds that were being flown over the border. I mean, this is very almost Cold War kind of nonsense. But that was also repeated. And you can also find traces of that story, in the world's media. I think this has been really successful. And the combination is Russia, China, the American far right, to a little bit extent, the far left, European far right, of course, as well. Has, usefully helped Russia in undermining cohesion around this story and undermining people's sense of, belief and understanding of the story. And I think it's been a very important part of the war. Because for Russia, how much better is it to spend what's really not very much money, even just throwing spaghetti at the wall and creating crazy stories that you put out in the U.S. press? How much more effective is that if you can get it to persuade Congress not to pass money on Ukraine? That's a lot more effective than actually fighting on the ground. And so the Russians have put a lot of thought and attention into how to use their information networks to undermine support for Ukraine. And now the new aspect is that they have other autocratic states helping them, notably China.
You're listening to Media Confidential with Alan Rusbridger and me, Lionel Barber. And after the break, we'll have more from Anne Applebaum, including whether or not the Russian nuclear threat has gone away, or should the West take the risk of nuclear war seriously. We'll be right back. I wonder whether you could also mention the nuclear threat, or maybe the nuclear bluff, that because Putin and Lavrov and obviously Medvedev have regularly threatened to use nuclear weapons, and this has always been reported at almost at face value throughout all sections of Western media.
I mean, this actually goes back a long way. They've been doing this for a long time, but you're right. Since before and particularly in the early part of the war, they talked constantly about nuclear weapons, and they still talk about it. And they still talk about eradicating Britain or destroying, Western cities. And of course, they do this as a way of scaring us or scaring the Western world and preventing us from aiding Ukraine. The idea is that if we help the Ukrainians too much, then somehow the Russians will nuke us. There's never been any evidence that the Russians are actually preparing to move or touch their nuclear weapons. We can see that, by the way. That's something we would have some advanced knowledge of. And we also know that for technical, tactical reasons, it's become clear that they can't really use them on the battlefield as battlefield weapons, mostly because, it would destroy Russian troops as well and might destroy areas of Russia as well. And it's also pretty clear that the Chinese, who have repeatedly said they don't want this to become a nuclear conflict in public, are also saying the same thing in private. So we have a lot of good reasons to doubt they would do it. And we also see that things that were supposed to provoke them, like hitting Russian targets, like hitting Russian infrastructure, haven't provoked them. And so, in fact, it was a bluff. But yes, I think that's another piece of propaganda that was very effective.
Final question from me, Anne. I'm just curious about how you inform yourself, and I'm sure you have lots of contacts and you bring them out and you speak to them. But I have a feeling that when I graze on Twitter, there are lots of sort of Bellingcat-style operations working from open sources, and there are think tanks, and there are academics, and there are military experts. I mean, there are hundreds and thousands of eyes on this war, and I just wonder how you personally monitor it all.
First of all, don't follow it on Twitter. Twitter is now really, and it happened amazingly. I mean, I can trace it. I mean, that has really now the number of Russian disinformation accounts, including people close to Elon Musk, is really extraordinary. So I wouldn't follow it there. But there are a few think tanks and a few experts whose views I trust who've been writing about the war all along. I mean, if you're asking about military developments, there are a few people. ISW, I guess it stands for the Institute for the Study of War, is a Washington and Kiev-based group who have been right about most things and who follow the war in great detail, if you want to follow it that way. There are, a couple of people. Michael Kaufman is an American, an American academic who's followed it. There are several people who you can follow who have accurate, we're now 2 years into the war, so you can judge people by what they've said in the past and by what, how right they were and what their estimates were. I also have, obviously, I have people in Kiev who I talk to find out both what's going on in terms of the military and what's going on politically. I mean, there are a couple of people online who look for the stuff on Telegram channels. These would be Russian Telegram channels that there's At War Translated is quite a good account that follows Russian Telegram and Ukrainian Telegram and publishes stuff. And there are a few others. I mean, so you sort of learn to follow the people who more or less are right and who don't make things up.
And how much visibility do you have into Russian thinking and Russian public opinion and the unofficial conversation in Russia?
So there is no such thing as public opinion in Russia. There is no polling that you can do in which people will honestly say what they think. There isn't a forum for public opinion that's normal. There's nothing you can read about that's very useful. I mean, I have some friends who are in the Russian opposition and they still have friends inside Russia. And and some of them are quite well connected and I talk to them to some extent. So I have some sense of what's going on. I talk to US and UK officials who might have reasons to know about what they think is going on. But it's a very closed society now. And as you know, there are very few reporters there. I think BBC is one of the last ones. It's very dangerous to be based there, as we know, because the Wall Street Journal's correspondent there was arrested. So it's true that most of what we know, certainly about the very inner circles and about the high levels of discussion in Russian society, is second or third hand. That's true.
And there's been a terrific conversation. Apart from reading you faithfully, I would also recommend Professor Larry Friedman. He's been really good. But thank you so much for appearing on the show and look forward to Autocracy Inc.
Thank you very much.
Well, that was very sobering from Anne Applebaum. And I guess the real risk here is that you get war fatigue amongst the readers and editors. And that comes at the very moment that actually this war is more important than ever because of Russian advances and the wholesale destruction of Kharkiv. So this is actually when the world should be paying attention.
I thought she was really fascinating. And I think three things are going on in media terms. One is cost. It's a very costly business to keep foreign correspondents abroad and insured, fed and watered and in communication with security details and so on and so forth. And that's a big factor when the economics of news is under such pressure. The second is this thing that we've talked about before, Lionel, with Rasmus Nielsen, this question of news avoidance. And I think as long as things were going well in the war, people were reading and feeling that we were winning. But recently, all the news has been bad, and I think people may be switching off reading. And that has a factor on the third thing, which is clicks and the metrics. So if newsroom managers can see that people are not reading stuff, they think, well, why are we covering it? Why are we going to this huge expense? And so I think you get into a sort of circle of switching off, which is really dangerous. And the only encouraging thing that I took from Anne's conversation is that she's a voracious reader in Europe, and the European papers are certainly not giving up on this.
Yeah, I obviously in America here, the focus is very much on the war in and conflict in Gaza. And I think that that has been to the detriment of serious coverage about Ukraine. It's not disappeared. And the second thing, and I'm picking up what you've just said, Alan, is the way in which Zelensky has been portrayed in the media. I mean, 2 years ago, he was the hero of the resistance. And he's very much a sort of almost a shadowy figure now compared to that. And that doesn't help. In the initial phase of the war, he was very much the focus and something which readers and journalists were identifying with.
But I thought fascinating this ability. In one way, it's a very, very difficult war to cover. It's certainly impossible to cover from the Russian side. And Anne was telling us how difficult it is to get actually live embedded coverage on the Ukrainian side. And yet the visibility from the air and from the sort of armchair analysts around the world who have got all this drone footage and can really follow the war almost in real time is a very new thing in warfare, I think.
That's certainly true. And most news organizations should be using that, those new sources to capture the full spectrum of coverage.
Shortly, we're going to be joined by Celia Richardson from the National Trust to explore just how woke their scones really are. But before that, this week's Prospect podcast focuses on the environmental impact of the war in Ukraine and the role that it plays in the destruction of the environment. Contributing editor Isabel Hilton has been talking to Margot Wallström, the former Minister of Foreign Affairs of Sweden. So follow and subscribe to the Prospect podcast. There's a rich archive of interviews with guest writers and regular columnists for Prospect. Also support the prospect of a better future with our 25% off spring sale. Prospect is a stronghold of independent and unbiased journalism needed now, arguably more than ever in this global election year. So contribute to a society driven by informed dialogue and constructive debate by subscribing to Prospect with our limited time 25% off discount at www.prospectmagazine.co.uk.
Now, don't let it be said that we shy away from the big issues here at Media Confidential, because what you are about to hear may cause incandescent rage amongst our more delicate listeners.
Trigger warning, I'm about to read a Daily Mail headline. National Trust secretly makes all its scones vegan. And they don't stop there. Critics condemn, quotes, woke, quotes, use of vegetable-based spread instead of butter.
And naturally, the word woke appears later in the article because the Mail suggested that this was a virtue-signalling betrayal in what looks like yet another row involving the charity.
Which was inevitably taken up by the Daily Telegraph too. So what fresh horror is this? How could they do such a thing? Both papers quoted the same disgruntled reader, Maud Newby, 64, as well as Bill Cash, who made some appalling joke about cancelling Madeira because of the colonial history of Madeira or something. I didn't quite get that.
Yeah, that's Bill Cash, the Eurosceptic Tory MP.
Maud Newby said, I can't stand the taste of the new scones. They're not traditional ones at all. They're all flatter, drier, and have an unappealing texture.
Well, I'm going to have to break it to Maud that the National Trust scones have been made without butter for many years, and in fact they publish all their recipes, so they're not keeping the ingredients to their scones a secret. But is there more to this story?
Well, we're joined now by Celia Richardson, who's Director of Communications for the National Trust. So the Daily Mail recently carried an outrage story about the National Trust going woke and using vegan vegetable-based spread instead of butter in its scones. And this was a story that was widely picked up and discussed elsewhere. And in order to discuss the implications of this bombshell story, we're now joined by Celia Richardson, who is the Communications Director of the National Trust. Celia, tell us, is there any truth in this story that you have gone woke and are using vegetable-based spreads instead of butter?
Well, the truth of the matter is that we are using vegetable-based spreads, which I think you and I might recall used to be called margarine. But we have been doing so for the whole of living memory. So no one at the National Trust can remember our classic tea room scone being made with anything but a vegetable spread or margarine. So that bit of it is true. But the first we heard of it was when the Daily Mail approached us. The Daily Mail approached our press office on the Friday of a bank holiday weekend, which is fairly standard. You know, the National Trust is what people do on a bank holiday weekend. So we often find stories that seem a bit cooked up on a bank holiday weekend. So they approached us with questions about vegetable-based spread. And then next thing we knew, there was a story about our scones having gone woke. And what the Mail said was, in what looks like yet another woke row for the charity. So the Mail created the woke row, then said it looked like yet another woke row. And of course, we'll keep having woke rows if people keep creating woke rows. So we did.
You say that there's nothing has changed. So when the Daily Mail says they are secretly making all their scones vegan, there's nothing secret about it and there's nothing new about it.
Well, it would be against the law for us to serve anything in secret. It's always been the case. But as you'll know, recently, I think the laws become ever tighter on ingredients. I think we probably did remove milk from our scones in the last decade. But it certainly wasn't anything that we've done in secret.
This is a silly story. But it's sort of one of a trend, isn't it? I mean, you are on the receiving end of this kind of stuff. I mean, what proportion of the stories that get written about the National Trust from this angle have any substance?
From this angle, very few, in fact. We've become a bit of a proxy in the culture wars for reasons we can discuss. And when we're arguing about scones, we're arguing about inclusion, or in the lingo of the culture wars, pandering to minorities. So scones are like a proxy of a proxy, if you like, in this story. But, you know, you'll often hear stories like this. At the moment, I don't know what's going on, but culture wars armies seem to be marching on their stomachs. We were accused of cancelling mushrooms, banning mushrooms 2 weeks ago, in the words of the Daily Mail, putting thousands of jobs at risk. Now, the truth was that a couple of years ago, we stopped serving mushrooms that have been grown in peat for very good reason. We don't need to serve mushrooms grown in peat, so we don't. But that doesn't mean we've banned mushrooms, putting thousands of jobs at risk. There's usually something, there's usually a hook, but it's usually far from what's being reported. And what tends to be being reported, we were accused of cancelling Christmas at the end of last year. I know the BBC was accused of cancelling Easter this Easter because of some change to its scheduling. And what's happening then, you know, the way that works is it's a story about pandering to minorities. So in this case, it would be vegans or younger people. And when it's Easter, you know, it's people who don't tend to celebrate Christian feasts. So you can always find a way of telling these stories. Actually, when we were accused of cancelling Easter, it was merely that alongside of all of our other schedules, we produced an inclusion calendar about other feasts and festivals that aren't celebrated our properties traditionally to enable people to do that. So there's usually something in them, but they are turned to a very particular light in order to turn them into a culture war story.
Yeah, Celia, let me try. I don't wish to be carrying water for the Daily Mail. I mean, so forgive me. But leaving aside the gastronomic angle to this story, let me simplify the question and ask you, has the National Trust gone woke in the presentation of history and the way in which history, slavery and other matters are presented in the exhibitions or of the country houses that form part of the National Trust, which is Charles Moore's allegation regularly put out in The Spectator?
Yeah, and it depends on how you define woke, doesn't it? In 2020, I think what you're probably referring to in the beginning of some of this stuff is that we published a report. It was really a register of 93 properties that was intended first and foremost for our curators, just to be able to explore the links between colonialism, historic slavery and the properties they were looking after. The idea was to contextualise the properties. It wasn't to radically change the way that we share the stories of the properties. It was to add rather than take away. But that's where some of this began. But the National Trust's always explored the context of the properties it worked in. And, you know, a lot of new evidence came to light with things like the Legacies of British Slavery database. So we were taking on board new evidence. And, we've always had to do that. Gone woke's a funny thing. The National Trust's been in rows for years about a thing that used to be called political correctness. Sometimes it was called bandwagoning. It's been called dad dancing. And woke's a really useful word. We had a very memorable headline recently in the Daily Star that was "Woke Row Deer Park's Kinky Dogging Shame." Now, you just can't get that with political correctness gone mad. It doesn't work. So woke's been very handy, but ask 20 people what woke means and you're not going to get the same answer twice.
And there's also been an attempt to attack the leadership and get changes in the whole governance of the National Trust beyond attacking the menus.
Yes, there has. I mean, we've had a campaign to change our council, which is elected by members, and the council appoints the board of trustees. So really, we're right in the heart of our governance then. That's not unheard of. You know, I think one of the most important things about understanding the culture wars is it isn't just, you know, one side against each other. It's complicated. And using a really established institution like the National Trust, using its reputation or its brand to divide people and create wedges, that's part of a populist approach. And I think, you know, you're either shouting into the void about your opinions or you're choosing a really helpful battleground. And if you choose the National Trust and, you know, accuse it of things in the culture wars, you can surprise people. It's a bit of an accelerant. So, yes, there's definitely a campaign. It's very alive. But certainly we've been in rows about nudism and nuclear weapons and flapjack recipes for decades. It's just some of the methods have changed, and you know, from my perspective, a little more worrying than it might have been 20 or 30 years ago. And a lot of the rows that we were having about wokeness or political correctness, they were happening at a time before we had so much populism, before we had things like GB News, before we had so many politicians entering the culture wars. So that's, I think, what's really changed just in the last 5 years. It's made my job and the jobs of people like me very different from the way we understood them 5 or 10 years ago.
Can I ask about your strategy for dealing with this? Because you're quite unusual as a comms director, and there are many comms directors who would be privately tearing their hair out of this, but would try and straight bat it. You're very active on Twitter. You're quite punchy. You're quite humorous. But you, as it were, you take the fight to them. Is that a deliberate strategy, and do you feel it's working?
Well, I think like anything you learn, we learn from failure. You know, the first, I suppose, year, I would say, or more of this, we kept trying to reassure people who didn't want to be reassured. We kept trying to reason with people who didn't want to be reasoned with. So we tried the straight bat. We tried the, I mean, don't get me wrong, with our press office and with National Trust channels, we still always use the straight bat. We answer all questions. We don't refuse questions, and we try to be as clear and transparent as we can, and we'll never stop doing that, or at least, you know, I believe we've got to keep doing that. However, I sort of got a bit aware of what was happening about in 2018, I think, before the National Trust. I was working for Historic England, which is an arm's length body of DCMS. And I sort of had to see off the first sort of proper organised attack that I was responsible for handling. And it was clear that a lot of the people getting involved, particularly on social media, a lot of the many people who were claiming freedom of information requests, etc., who were writing to the Secretary of State, they weren't even coming from the UK. So some of what was happening wasn't very real. So what I did then was book myself on the government's own counter disinformation training, and learned how to deal with disinformation and misinformation. And that's largely what we're dealing with here. So the most important thing I learned was don't use your main channels for dealing with this stuff. So, you know, we've got 1 million followers on Twitter. We've got probably 1 million followers, I can't remember off the top of my head, on Instagram. So if we're using that channel to deal with disinformation, then lots of people who are actually visiting our channels because they want a visit, they want to find out about wildlife or a painting, you're in the middle of using those channels for counter disinformation. And that's what entryists want. So you don't use those channels. And Directors of communications, like me, are usually followed by journalists. We're often followed by policymakers and politicians. So you do have a reasonably useful channel in your own right for dealing with this stuff. So that's why I started using more my own platform, my own channel, because otherwise, you know, the people who are fighting us are getting exactly what they want, which is oxygen, which is the National Trust being dragged into things, and which is lots more followers for themselves, because we're handing them followers.
Final question from me, Celia. Are you 100% sure that this hasn't come from Joe Lycett?
You're not the first person to ask. We actually thought it was an April Fool's. It seemed so obvious. I think I said I've had the scone on my culture wars bingo card for quite some time. So we did wonder if it was an April Fool, but there's no sign of that being the thing. And I don't think it has come from Joe Lycett. No, I mean, if you're accused of cancelling mushrooms and it gets a lot of clicks 2 weeks earlier, then, you know, changing the scone to make that woke is probably a really, really sensible next step if what you're driving for is clicks. And I think, you know, a lot of the newspapers printing these stories are.
Well, Celia, it's been fascinating talking to you. And when you talk about stopping playing with a straight bat, I'm tempted to use the cricket metaphor that you're now playing bazball, reverse sweeps, hitting sixes. It's great stuff. I'm sure the crowd love it. And do you think you're actually making a dent, though? Are you actually succeeding in turning back this assault?
Well, I don't know about me personally, but I certainly think the National Trust overall is, you'd never say winning because we would never pick this fight. But what has been happening steadily over the last 3 or 4 years is an increase in public trust. Independent research has found that the National Trust is now the second most trusted institution in the UK after the NHS, which is not a bad place to be. Our members are voting in record numbers. So unlike most institutions, we have members with voting rights. So actually, I think at a time when lots of institutions are losing public trust, when they're getting dragged into the culture wars, that's not been happening to the National Trust. I'd never say never. I don't know what's around the corner. But I think A, playing a straight bat institutionally, and B, having somebody who can debunk myths clearly, seems to have worked so far.
Thank you, Celia. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, I'm glad we had Celia on because I enjoy her Twitter feed where she is extremely feisty in dealing with, I think you might almost call them conspiracy theories. I mean, it's an awful lot of rubbish which is written about the National Trust. And there is a well-funded organization based, I think, in Tufton Street, the home of a lot of right-wing think tanks trying to overthrow the current management. And they're all as ridiculous as this story, and I rather feel for her in having to mop up after these stories are just dumped in the world's lap.
I feel for her, but I think that this is a case study in counter-offensive PR. I thought it was fascinating how she highlighted using her own channel rather than the trusted National Trust social media feeds to counter these dodgy stories. And then also she clearly understands that this is part of a wider cultural war. And you're kind of operating, therefore, on various levels. It was impressive what she's doing to counter the vegan offensive.
And I'm glad we had common pronunciation of scone. There wasn't a scone split between us, Lionel, because that would have ruined a close friendship. That's all from Media Confidential. So thank you to today's guests, Celia Richardson and Anne Applebaum. We'll be back next week. Will you be back next week, Lionel, or are you heading off somewhere else entirely?
No, I will be back in London. I'll be seated, but without wearing a tie. So looking forward to seeing you.
We can treat you to a scone. Do send any questions or comments to Media Confidential at Prospect Magazine or oneword.co.uk, or get in touch with us on X, formerly Twitter, where we are at Media Conf Pod. Thank you all for listening to Media Confidential, which is brought to you by Prospect Magazine and Fresh Air. The producer is Martin Points Roberts.
And remember to listen and follow Media Confidential wherever you get your podcasts, and join us next week for more invaluable analysis.